For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Welcome, everyone. Glad you could make it. I'm Taigen Layton from Ancient Dragon Zengate and also representing Buddhist Peace Fellowship Chicago. And we're very happy to have Ruth Ozeki here in Chicago. Ruth Ozeki is, among other things, a Zen Buddhist priest. She's also a writer and a filmmaker, award-winning filmmaker, a writer of a number of books. There are some of her books available for sale out front. Today she's going to be talking about a really extraordinary book, A Tale for the Time Being. It's a novel, but also it's about many deep truths. It's about time itself and the bendability and fluidity of time. It's about World War II. It's about war and peace. It's about Japan and America. It's about Japanese Zen. It's about teenage girls. It's about a 100 plus year old Japanese nun. It's about how our culture and Japanese culture meet or don't meet. It's really an extraordinary book, and it has to do with Zen meditation and how time unfolds in that. And yet, it's a very entertaining novel. So I'm really happy to have Ruth here in Chicago with us. So thank you, Ruth, for coming.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Let me add one thing. That if you have friends who couldn't make it here, tomorrow morning at 10:15, Ruth will be speaking also at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate Temple on Irving Park Road, right here in Irving Park, Brown.
Thank you so much, Dan, and thank you, Tom. It's wonderful. It's wonderful to be here. I just was in LA and doing some talks at Loyola Marymount University there. And I guess it was the night before last. I spent a very, very, very exciting evening watching Game 7. And it was made even more exciting knowing that I was going to be here in Chicago. And so I was really rooting for you guys. I was really rooting for the Cubs. And obviously it made a tremendous difference. So, yeah. Yeah, no, you're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome. I also felt it was a very auspicious, I kind of knew that the Cubs would win because, you know, it was an auspicious number. 108 is a very auspicious number in Buddhism. And there, you know, 108 beads on a Buddhist mala, rose, you know, and 108 beads on a Catholic rosary too, right? Isn't that correct? And 108 stitches in a baseball. So all of this converged in a way that made it very clear to me that the Cubs were going to win. I know that some people were not so convinced, but I knew. I'm using a new piece of technology today. So hopefully this will work. And actually, I'm going to use, that's better. Good. I'm going to use this piece of technology, too. Can you all hear me? Everybody can hear me? Great. Okay. So what I'd like to do this afternoon is to talk a little bit about A Tale for the Time Being and tell you some of the things from my own life that ended up in the novel. I'm just curious, how many people have read the book or are familiar with it? Oh, good. Okay, good, good, good. So hopefully, you know, this will, you know, you know this already. You know already that there are many things from my own life that have ended up in this novel. And as a writer, I think it's kind of interesting the way that random pieces of one's life end up in literature. And so this is something I'd like to talk about a little bit. I'd also like to read a bit from the book so that you can hear the way that I first heard the book when it came to me. Novels very often come to me as voices. And so I always think it's interesting to, you know, to hear an author read a little bit because it gives you a sense of how the voices sound. So I'll do a little of that. And I'd also like to talk a little bit about superpower. And those of you who have read the book know what superpower is, but don't worry if you haven't, because you have a superpower. You have a superpower. And by the end of this afternoon, you will know what it is and what to do with it. So, and then at the end, I'd also like to leave some time for questions and, you know, some conversation, some more general conversation. So that's my plan for today, and let's just see how much of this we get through. So I'd like to start by talking about time and about time being and about being a time being. You know, what is a time being exactly? And what does it mean to be one? The phrase time being first caught my attention back in 2006. No, sorry, it was earlier than that. It was in 2002, 2003, when I was studying. I was doing some intensive studying of a 13th century Zen master named Dogen Zenji, and Dogen wrote some very beautiful and poetic and very perplexing essays on the subject of time, and he is unusual because he amongst spiritual writers because he treats time as a spiritual matter. So one of these essays was called Uji in Japanese. And this is your little Japanese lesson for the day. The Japanese character U, okay, in English means being or existence. And the character Ji means time. So the word has been translated into English in a variety of different ways, but the translation that I was reading translated the essay as the time being. Okay, and this phrase, time being, kind of stuck in my mind, and the reason it stuck in my mind was because it's unstable. Okay, and what I mean by that is that its meaning changes depending on how you inflect it. Right, how you pronounce it. So if you put the emphasis on the second word, time being, it means temporarily or for now, which is the normal usage of the word. But if you place the emphasis on the first word, time being, right, it suggests a being, like a human being or an alien being, right? In other words, an entity made out of time. So this is interesting to me because I'm a big Doctor Who fan, right? And so this, you know, I was immediately thinking about like the Time Lords, you know, these beings made out of time. So anyway, as I was reading Dogen's essay, I kept stumbling across the phrase, and very often the phrase for the time being is translated and appears very often in the essay, and sometimes I would read it for the time being, and other times I would read it for the time being. Okay, and each time I read this phrase, I would sort of stumble across it, and it felt somehow as if the phrase was refusing to settle. Right, it was refusing to resolve into one thing or another, like it had almost a will or a spirit of its own. Right, that was really trying to come to life, and it stuck with me for a couple of years, until in December of 2006, this voice came into my head, and it was the voice of a young Japanese schoolgirl. And she introduced herself to me, and I'll just read the first page or so of the novel so that you can hear the voice the way that I heard it. Hi. My name is Nao, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is or was or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you, somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you. Who are you, and what are you doing? Are you in a New York subway car hanging from a strap, or soaking in your hot tub in Sunnyvale? Are you sunbathing on a sandy beach in Phuket, or having your toenails buffed in Abu Dhabi? Are you a male, or a female, or somewhere in between? Is your girlfriend cooking you a yummy dinner, or are you eating cold Chinese noodles from a box? Are you curled up with your back turned coldly towards your snoring wife, or are you eagerly waiting for your beautiful lover to finish his bath so you can make passionate love to him? Do you have a cat? And is she sitting on your lap? Does her forehead smell like cedar trees and fresh, sweet air? Actually, it doesn't matter very much, because by the time you read this, everything will be different, and you will be nowhere in particular, flipping idly through the pages of this book, which happens to be the diary of my last days on Earth, wondering if you should keep on reading. And if you decide not to read anymore, hey, no problem, because you're not the one I was waiting for anyway. But if you do decide to read on, then guess what? You're my kind of time being. And together, we'll make magic. So this was promising, right? It was promising to hear, you know, to hear this quality of voice, right? And I was very excited. And as I said, you know, novels very often come to me as voices. And as soon as I heard Nao's voice, the voice of this young girl, Nao Yasutani, I knew certain things about her. I knew that she was a Japanese schoolgirl, a junior high school student. I knew that she lived in Tokyo, and she was sitting in a maid cafe, writing in some kind of diary. She was probably sitting in a maid cafe because my husband had just sent me a link to maid cafes, and so you know, this is where Nao appeared. I knew that she was troubled and possibly suicidal, but even so, she had this kind of spunky attitude and sense of humor. I knew that she was writing in English, which was odd, because why would a Japanese schoolgirl be writing in English? And I also knew that she was writing to someone, which was interesting. Odd, because normally we write diaries for ourselves, right? So why would this girl be writing to someone else? But clearly she had a reader in mind. There was somebody there who she knew that somebody would pick up this diary at some point and read it. And she had all of the confidence of a young writer sort of casting her words out into the world, you know, just certain that somebody would pick it up and read it. And also knowing that when that happened, something magical would happen. The problem was that Nao didn't know who her reader was. And so, as a result, neither did I. Okay. And this is, you know, it was my job then as a novelist to figure this out. You know, who is now Yasutani's reader? And this took me a very long time. This took me about 5 years to figure this out. 5 years is, it used to be that in publishing, it was perfectly respectable for a novelist to take 5 or 10 years to write and publish a novel. That is not the case anymore. These days, you know, publishers want novels, you know, once every year, once every 2 years. So, you know, the pace of everything, right? The pace of everything has been accelerated. So 5 years is an achingly long time for a novelist, especially one, as I was at the time, who hadn't published a novel in a decade. Okay. But, you know, I'd been obsessing about time long before Nao's voice came to me. My interest in time started back in 1998, I think, and that was the year that my father died. And, you know, there's nothing like the death of a parent to make you keenly aware of time passing. But if you remember, everyone was keenly aware of time back in 1998. We were on the cusp of a new millennium, and already this seems like, you know, this seems like so long ago. But if you remember, the turn of the millennium was an event that seemed terribly significant at that moment. And at the same time, it also felt completely arbitrary. So it was confusing. I remember feeling like, is this important or is this not important? It felt very special to be alive at the turn of a millennium because, you know, human beings are such short-lived time beings, and not many of us get to experience the turn of a millennium. But, you know, so what, right? You know, redwood trees are much more likely to experience the turn of a millennium than we are, but redwood trees don't care, right? So, you know, this was the kind of conundrum that I felt caught in. You know, as a human being, it felt like a great big deal, and we were making a huge fuss about it. You probably remember all of the apocalyptic prophecies about the end of the world that were flying around back then. You remember Y2K, right? And the millennial bug that was going to shut down all of the computers and the government and banks all over the world. And of course, nothing happened, right? We were all stockpiling water and flashlight batteries and things like that. And nothing happened. And then a year later, it was 2001, right? And 2001, you know, for those of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s, 2001 was a big, iconic year because of Stanley Kubrick's film, 2001, A Space Odyssey. And I remember I saw that film, it was in 1968 when it came out, and I saw that film in a theater. I was 12 years old. And I saw it in a theater because, you know, back then, if you recall, we didn't have VCRs, right? We didn't have on-demand, streaming internet. So I went to a real theater and saw it there. And I remember 2012 represented a future that was so, you know, distant, it was unimaginable. Right, and if you look at the film now, and I really think it's a wonderful thing to go back and look at it now, look at it again, you'll just laugh. Right? So in any case, there we were in 2001, and you know the weeks and months passed, and then the sun rose on that bright blue morning of September 11th, right? And 9/11 wasn't the end of the world either, but there were moments when it certainly felt like the end of the world, and I'm sure you'll all remember that. I was in Wisconsin at the time, and I'd gone there to give a talk at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and I remember watching those planes crashing into the towers, into the twin towers of the World Trade Center, and the towers falling, and I rented a car and drove all the way back home across the continent to the remote island in British Columbia, where I was living, so that I could be with my mother, who was living with us at the time. And if you've read A Tale for the Time Being, this story will sound familiar to you. And this is where another element of the novel fell into place. In the wake of 9/11, all of the pundits and the news commentators were comparing the terrorist attacks to the kamikaze bombings of World War II. And the New York Times at that point printed an op-ed piece by an anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin who was critiquing this comparison. And she had just published a book called Kamikaze, Cherry Blossoms, and Nationalisms. And the book was an analysis of the letters and diaries of the young kamikaze pilots during World War II. And I had, I saw the op-ed piece and I read it and was very intrigued by it, tracked down the book, and started reading these diaries and these letters. And they were astonishing. They were these beautiful, poetic, learned writings which revealed that the pilots were not the fundamentalist, imperialist fanatics that history and World War II propaganda had painted them to be. On the contrary, many of them were sensitive, intellectual, young college students, you know, like the college students here or at any university, who had been drafted and forced to fly these suicide missions in support of a war that they opposed, but in order to help defend a country that they loved. Their writing detailed the struggle that they went through in intimate detail, the struggle that they went through to make sense of this predicament, right? And to live what remained of their lives in the face of this certain death. And it was heartbreaking to read this. Now, I grew up in the shadow of World War II, but these were stories that I'd never heard before. And these young men, I realized, were time beings who had dropped out of time, leaving these kind of ghostly holes and gaps in the historical record. And I felt haunted by this absence. And from this haunting, the character of Haruki number one was born. And I started writing several different novels in the wake of 9/11. I started writing several different novels about this young philosophy student, student pilot. But none of the novels worked. Right, for various reasons, none of these novels really took off, and so I abandoned them. But I kept hoping that at some point I would find a fictional home for this character and find some way of writing his story. And also, just to tell you the truth, you know, my writing wasn't going very well at this point. I was in a bit of a funk during those first few years of the millennium. I kept starting and abandoning novels. And in desperation, I started writing a memoir about my mother. And this might also sound familiar. My mother had Alzheimer's, and I was taking care of her. And she was almost 90 by then and losing her short-term memory. She could remember things that had happened a long time ago in her childhood in Hawaii, but she couldn't remember what had happened a few days or even a few moments earlier. So it was like she was traveling backwards in time. And little by little, her recent memories were dissolving, and only the old ones remained, sort of beautifully preserved, you know, like insects in amber. She was an ancient time being dropping out of time, and I thought I could write about this in my memoir. I thought I could write about taking care of her, about her stories, and about her fascinating life. So these were some of the things that were happening in my life at the time, and it was a hard time. It was sad, and it was frightening, and it was frustrating. And I'd had a casual meditation practice for quite some time, but after my father died and I started taking care of my mother, I started taking my Zen practice very seriously. I needed to find some way of working with my feelings of grief and frustration and fear. I wanted to better understand this heartbreaking and unavoidable fact that we are time beings with a time limit. And this is what led me to read Dogen's essay, Uji, or the time being. So in retrospect, you can see how these events and all of the stuff that I was thinking about sort of came together to create the conditions out of which the book arose. A writer's mind, I always think of a writer's mind as being, you know, sort of like a mental gyre, right? And all of the little bits and pieces of you know, life and information, you know, get swept up in the gyre and, you know, churned around and around and around, and then they start to get spit out, right? And in my case, because I'm a fiction writer, they get spit out as characters and scenes in fiction. So, you know, this is how Now's voice sort of emerged. And I started, you know, I started hearing her diary and writing it. So it was clear to me the whole time that Now had a reader. Okay, it was very clear to me that she needed, you know, she had a reader, she was going to have a reader. But I didn't quite know how to, you know, I didn't know who that reader was. So then the process that came later was interesting, because I ended up writing four or five different versions of the book with different readers in place, right? And it was a process that was very much like auditioning an actor for the role in a film. I had this fictional world that I was creating. I would invite a character in, a potential reader in, to the fictional world. I would arrange for that reader to find Now's diary. He or she would start to read it, right, and start to react. And then this would draw you know, because of the relationship between writer and reader, you know, the reader's response would draw now out in different, you know, slightly different ways. And little by little, you know, the fictional world would start to grow, and it would start to get kind of all plump and juicy and delicious the way fictional worlds can get. And then usually about 50 or 100 pages in, suddenly the whole thing would collapse, right? And I would wake up and I would, you know, open up the manuscript and I would read it and I would think, nope, wrong reader. You know, this isn't going to work. And so then I would, you know, politely thank the reader and usher him or her out of the novel and then, you know, go through a suitable period of grieving and writer's block, and then I'd think of another reader, right? And so then I would invite that reader in, and that reader would find the diary, and we'd, you know, go through the whole process all over again. So this process continued. I think I went through it about 4 or 5 times, and what was interesting about it is that every time I did it, Now's diary grew a little bit longer in response to the new reader, you know, the new reader entering the world. Finally, by the beginning of, well, it was the end of 2010, I had finished a draft of the book, okay, and it was a complete draft. It was probably about 500-something pages. It was completely different than the book that you have all read. It was set in an urban center, not on a remote island in British Columbia. The character of the reader was certainly not Ruth. Most of it was set in a library. Okay, so it was very, very different from the book that you read. Different plot, you know. Now's diary was you know, similar, but also different. And the book had terrible problems. I mean, I knew it wasn't a very good draft, but I turned it into my agent and we were, you know, she agreed. She said it was not a very good draft. But we decided to, you know, she said, you know, let's submit it to your editor and we'll hope that your editor can help you figure this out. And so I was just about to do this, and this was in March of 2011. And just as I was about to send it in, the earthquake and tsunami struck the coast of Japan. Okay. And I spent the next few weeks, I have friends and family in Tohoku, in Sendai and in Tokyo. And so I spent those first days, and I'm sure many of you did too, just watching YouTube, watching the videos of the wave, you know, coming in and just destroying, you know, just taking out towns and villages all up and down the coastline. My first concerns, of course, were personal concerns, and you know, I was trying to track down my friends and my family, which I did, and everyone was okay. And then the Fukushima nuclear reactor started to explode. And that's really when my worry turned global. I realized that the world was, as a result of this, now a completely different place. And Japan was a different place. And I think that's when it hit me that this novel that I had written was now completely irrelevant. Right. There are certain catastrophic events that occur, and 9/11 was certainly one of these, that create a kind of rift in time, right? And it sort of separates time into, you know, before and after. And, you know, it was, if you remember, after 9/11, there was a period where novelists were having a very difficult time writing about New York because nobody knew what New York was anymore. Right, New York was a different place. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody knew what it would become. And the same thing, I think, was happening in Japan. I had written a pre-earthquake, pre-tsunami, pre-Fukushima book, and now we were living in this post-earthquake, post-tsunami, post-Fukushima world. So I didn't, you know, I withdrew the book from submission and thinking pretty much that was the end of it. But Now's voice just kept coming back to me, and I it was almost like I couldn't abandon her. And finally, you know, my husband, Oliver, and if you've read the book, you know Oliver. Oliver came up with a solution, okay? And he pointed out that the earthquake and tsunami were these very real, devastating events, and that they had broken the world, right? And they had certainly broken the fictional world of my novel. And if that was the case, then the only appropriate response to this was to allow that brokenness to continue, you know, to allow the brokenness to be. And the way that I could accomplish this was, for me, as a very, you know, real writer, a very real author, to enter the fictional world as a character myself. Okay, it's a metafictional device, but you know, and I usually shy away from these, but in this case, there was a very good reason to do it, and I realized that the reader of Now's diary had to be me. Okay, and so I thanked my husband, and I informed him that, you know, if I were going to be in the book, then he would need to be in the book too. And thankfully, he agreed. He said he thought it would be an interesting thought experiment. Okay. So I went back to my desk and dismantled the manuscript. You know, it had been written once again in interleaved chapters. So I went back and I just unzipped it, and I threw about half of it away, which was probably about 300 pages. And I started writing again. And this time I used myself and Oliver as fictional characters in the book and put the earthquake and tsunami and the meltdown of Fukushima in the heart of the novel. And once I did that, everything else fell into place. And I remember I started writing this in May of 2011, and I, you know, wrote and wrote and wrote and finished the book by November, by Thanksgiving. So really it was a matter of 5 or 6 months that, you know, I ended up writing, you know, almost 2/3 of the novel after this very, very, very long period of, you know, of trying. And I think I learned something very important here, which is that novels are time beings too. You know, they take the time they take, and you can't rush them. So let's see, how are we doing for time? Speaking about time. Okay, we're doing okay. So I just wanted to say a couple more things on the subject of time. The years I spent studying Dogen's Uji and his teaching on time got me thinking about the way that we understand or misunderstand time. You know, I think it's safe to say that we all live pretty busy lives, right? Everybody feel like we live a kind of busy life. I mean, maybe some of you, maybe you have lots of time. I don't know. Maybe a lot of you are Zen practitioners and you have lots and lots of time. But I certainly feel like I am constantly stressed for time. And, you know, we never seem to have enough time to answer all of our email and to, you know, to get everything done that we need to do. And somehow feeling like we're always behind, right? So that's interesting, right? Behind, like, what? But we feel like we're always behind. And there's a feeling, too, of being sort of out of sync with time, right? Or having a kind of an antagonistic relationship with time, right? That there's just, you're fighting it, right, somehow. And I think this feeling of being out of sync with time is a function of the times that we live in. And I'll just give you a few examples of that. You know, we live in an age that is very much defined by materialism and corporate capitalism, obviously. And so when we look at time through this capitalist, materialist lens, we naturally view it, experience it as something material too, right? We experience time as a quantifiable and limited commodity, right? A finite resource. It's something that is ours to consume, and our language, of course, reflects this. So we talk about spending time, we talk about wasting time, keeping time, running out of time, killing time, saving time, right? Taking our time, losing time, all of these expressions. In Western contemporary culture, too, we have a very linear view of time. Time has a beginning and time has an ending. But of course, the linear time is only one way of experiencing time. You know, in many ancient cultures, Mayan and Native American, Greek, Hindu, early Buddhist cultures, time is understood as something that is cyclical, right? These great sort of temporal gyres, you know, very much timed with the cycle of the seasons that are endlessly replenishing and renewing themselves. The ancient Greeks, too, had two different words for time. You probably know this, chronos and kairos. And chronos describes a quantifiable chronological time, very much the way we experience time. But kairos describes something else. It's a qualitative or almost metaphysical time, literally the right or opportune moment, which is in which something happens. So it's more like more akin to our notion of timeliness. Okay. And then, of course, there's Dogen Zenji and his wonderfully all-inclusive view of time as being, time as existence itself, which was not dissimilar to what Heidegger described 700 years later in his philosophical work, Being and Time. So the way we describe or map time determines the way that we experience it, right? Because we're a linear, progress-driven culture, we think of the past as existing somewhere behind us, right? We think of the past as existing somewhere behind us and that we're making progress into the future, right? Does that make sense, right? But not everyone uses the same mental map. The Aymara tribe in Peru, for example, and I think this was true for ancient China as well, view the past as being in front of us, right? And the future behind. And why is this? Well, you know, if the past is in front of us, the past is in front of us because we can see it, right? We know it. Right, we know what happened in the past. So the past is in front of us. It's right here. You know your dead ancestors who have gone before you. They're always with you, leading the way. But the future is an unknown, right? It's in a place where you can't see. So it's behind you, right? And so, you know, that's interesting, right? It's like, oh, what's that? Oh, it's my future trailing around, you know, trailing behind me. So, you know, these are examples of how that illustrate how our contemporary way of experiencing time in the West is only one way, and it's a way that is limited by the lens of our time. Our materialist, capitalist, consumerist lens renders time as a quantifiable, linear, limited commodity, and so that's how we experience it. Right, the clock is ticking like time through the hourglass. These are the days of our lives. I used to be a filmmaker. Now I'm having a hard time seeing you all. Okay, there. I used to be a filmmaker, so this metaphor of the lens is one that that really interests me. Lenses distort our perception of space the way that clocks distort our perception of time. Okay. If you look at the world through a telephoto lens, for example, the lens shortens the distance between you and the subject that you're looking at, and it narrows your visual field, and it makes everything look taller and slimmer, right? So if you want to be photographed as a tall, slim person, make sure that you're photographed with a telephoto lens. If you're a wide-angle lens, for example, expands your visual field, but it makes things look very far away, and it makes it look wider, too. And a fisheye lens gives you the widest visual field, but it makes all objects round, and it makes straight lines curved. So if you're born with a fisheye lens attached to your face, and you've only viewed the world through that lens, you might actually imagine that the world is spherical, and people are all round and short. You would have no way of knowing anything else because lenses are clear and transparent and you can't see them, right? You can only see their effects. And I think this is exactly what's happened to our perception of time. You know, our watches and our timers and our calendars and our schedules, our time management systems. Hang on. Oh, I see what I can do there. Our time management systems and our obsession with efficiency and speed and productivity have distorted our experience of time as well as our experience of being. Oops. Hang on. And so as a result, I think we're suffering from a kind of temporal dysfunction, you know, a distemporality. But since the lens that we are viewing or experiencing this with is largely invisible, we mistake this dysfunction for what is real, for reality. And from time to time, we get a sense that there's something wrong, right? We might feel exhausted and anxious and overwhelmed, and we feel, too, this you know, there's something more to life. But, you know, most of the time we just kind of go along with the program. And, you know, I think that, those moments when the lens slips slightly are really precious moments, because they remind us. They remind us that this is, in fact, a lens. And that there are ways of shifting, right? Shifting our experience of time. There are ways of shifting from chronos to kairos, from quantitative to qualitative time, from linear time to timelessness. You know, we can choose to step out of the rat race and experience different kinds of timescapes. And certainly art, you know, literature, music, philosophy, religion, ritual, all of these provide more expansive and embodied ways of being in time. And of course, so does spending time in nature, right? Spending time amongst trees and or on the desert gives you a completely different sense of time and and timescape. When you read a great book, or you look at a painting, or listen to a symphony, or take part in some kind of communion ritual, you're participating in time in a different way. And needless to say, the same holds true if you make art, or make music, play music, write novels, or even simply take a walk. Deep meditation and concentration do something similar. And in fact, I think when you meditate, being in time is all you're doing, right? That's really what meditation is. And so this brings us back to superpower. Okay. If you've read A Tale for the Time Being, you know that this is a term that old Jiko uses to describe the power of zazen, or Zen meditation. So, you know, what is meditation, and why is it a superpower? Why is it a superpower? Well, it sounds quite simple, and it is quite simple. You know, it's just stepping out of the mad forward rush of time, and sitting still and fully experiencing what it is to be in time, to be a time being. In the Dogen Zenji tradition of zazen, you don't really practice with a goal in mind. It's not like you're trying to get somewhere other than where you are, right? When you meditate, you allow your body to become still and quiet, and you settle your attention on one thing. Usually it's the breath. And this allows you to experience each moment as it's passing, right? In a very intimate way. And so in this sense, Dogen Zenji's, you know, form of zazen is a way of training yourself to fully be who you are, you know, fully awake and fully present, you know, in moment to moment, right, in each moment. You know, the reality is, of course, when we're meditating, we're not doing that, right? We're sort of casting off. We're spinning, you know, we're thinking about the, you know, we're thinking about the future, or depending on where you're thinking about the future and worrying about the past, and, you know, thinking about all of the things that I should have done, or, you know, want to do, and so it's you know, we fall out of time with some regularity, and you know, that's not really a problem. Right? When that happens, you notice that that's happening. Minds are meant to think, so, you know, this will happen. When you notice it's happening, you catch yourself, and then you return to the breath, right? And very often, we talk about meditation as a practice of return, right? The practice of, you know, coming back, right? And so, you know, you spin off and you come back. You spin off and you come back. It's just returning this over and over again. And if you continue to do this over time, right, you start to develop a sense of a sense of real faith and confidence in your ability to be who you are. You know, be the time being who you are. Right, and so it's a you know, this idea of meditation as a way of coming home to yourself. Right, coming home to your mind, coming home to your body. And so, what I was thinking we could do is just spend a moment and practicing this together. Are you up for that? Okay. We'll do what old Jiko has asked us to do. Okay. And I'm trying to think how best to do this. I think I'll just stand here. That's fine. In Buddhism, we talk about four noble postures: sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. These are the four noble postures for meditation. I'm not going to suggest we lie down here, but you can sit, and I'll stand, and I think we'll be fine. Okay. So the first thing I'd like to ask you to do is to put down everything that you're holding in your hands. So just you can put everything down on the floor. And then you can sit up straight in your chair. And if you'd like, you can move forward a little bit, if it's comfortable for you to move forward a little bit, so you're a little bit on the edge of your chair and you're supporting yourself. So you're not leaning back, you know, you're not leaning back on the back of the chair, but you're holding yourself in a nice upright posture. And you can pay attention to this and pay attention to your body. And it's not a rigid military posture. It's just it's more of a feeling of being uplifted from inside. So it's a relaxed posture, but it's nice and upright. And you can, if it's comfortable for you, to move your feet slightly apart so that your 2 feet and your body are forming a kind of a tripod, and that's a nice stable posture. Good. And you can take your hands, and I know some of you are Zen practitioners and will probably want to do this, which is a cosmic mudra, but you can also just put your hands on your knees, and that's also a nice stable posture to sit in. Good, 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 good. Okay. And in traditional Zen, we usually meditate with our eyes open, but since we're all sitting in, you know, in Zen we usually face a blank wall, so, you know, nothing gets in our field of vision. But I think for today, what I'm going to suggest is that we all close our eyes. Okay. So you can just close your eyes and just take a moment to take a nice deep breath. And then exhale at your own pace. And you can take another nice inhalation. And as you breathe, just be aware of the breath entering your body. And use the exhalation as an opportunity to relax. And we'll do a very brief body scan, just bringing your awareness to the top of your head, to your scalp, noticing any sensation in the top of your head. And then bringing your awareness, allowing it to drop down into your forehead, your temples, your jaw, your mouth. Just relaxing all of the little muscles in your face. And then bringing your awareness down back of your head, into your neck, your throat, your shoulders. Again, just allowing the gentle touch of your awareness to help you relax. And then coming down through your arms, your elbows, your forearms, all the way down into the palms of your hand. Just take a moment to notice the pressure of your palms against your knees or cupping each other. Notice that sensation. And then on the next inhalation, just bring your awareness up into your chest, feeling the air expanding your lungs, your rib cage. Noticing as you breathe the little shifts of your clothing against your skin. and then dropping down into your belly. And really taking a moment here to just relax your stomach, relax your belly completely. We hold a lot of tension in our stomach, so you can just let it go. And then continuing down into your pelvis, noticing the pressure of the chair supporting you, and down your legs, knees, your shins, your ankles, all the way down to your feet. And here, once again, just take a moment to notice the pressure of the ground beneath you, supporting you. And then allow your awareness to come back and fill your body. Just checking in any places where you now know you hold tension and allowing that tension to relax. And then bringing your awareness very lightly on your breath. Following your breath in and following it out again. And if thoughts come, that's not a problem. Just notice that you're thinking and let them go. And return your awareness back to your breath again. And we'll sit like this in silence for another minute or two. And then with your eyes still closed, you can take a moment to bring a little movement back into your body. You might want to rock forward and backward, from side to side, just getting a sense of your body in space again. And if you'd like, you can take your hands and give yourself a little neck rub. Rub your shoulders and your neck, and then rub your face and your eyes. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Good. So how was that? How did that feel? Is that nice? Good. How many of you found that easy? How many of you found that easy? Okay. How many of you found it a little bit difficult, a little bit challenging? Okay. Okay, good, good. How many of you felt sleepy? Yeah, I mean, it's warm in here, and it's afternoon, and yeah, my iPad fell asleep, so. how many of you felt kind of, you know, jumpy, like your mind was jumping around? Yeah, that's very, very common, too. That's very common, too. In Buddhism, it's very often, we talk about it as monkey mind, right? So your mind is like a little monkey jumping around. How many of you felt that time was passing slowly? And how many felt that time was passing very quickly? Yeah. I have no idea how long actually passed, and I'm always a little bit worried because I think, well, you know, I could just sit here, and and the sun would go down, and you know. How many of you felt that you were doing it right? Okay. And how many of you felt like you were doing it wrong? Yeah, okay. Good. So the good news is that there's really no right or wrong here. Right, okay. So whatever you experienced is your experience, right? That is your experience of your meditation today. So now you know, right? There's no right or wrong. But of course we're always very, very quick to label our experience right or wrong. Okay, so that's useful too. So you can notice that, right? And if you're thinking, oh, I am really a good meditator, right? I really ace that, right? That's good. You should notice that, right? And if those of you who are thinking, oh, I really blew that. I don't know how to do this. I'm so bad at meditation. So you notice that too, right? These are just thoughts. These are just, you know, the way that we judge our experience all the time. And it's useful to notice that, and it's just another thought, and when you find yourself making those kinds of judgments, you can relax and let those judgments go, right? It's very simple, and return to the breath. And you practice this over and over again, and you notice, you know, how judgmental you are, right? And you know, not just about meditation, but if you're judging yourself in meditation, you know that you're probably judging yourself in other fields too. As a writer, I know this. I judge myself constantly, right? But once again, you know, this practice of noticing the judging mind and, you know, relaxing that kind of constant evaluation, just relaxing it and letting it go and returning to, you know, in meditation, returning to the breath, in writing, returning to the page, you know, just returning over and over again, right? Eventually it gets easier to recognize these as simply, you know, thoughts that your mind is churning up. And certainly as a novelist who writes very, very slowly and takes an achingly long time to finish a novel, these practices are very useful to me. So this is something that I highly recommend. And there are lots of people here who practice, and I think there are lots of practice opportunities in Chicago. So for those of you who want more practice opportunities, Dan Tigan you can talk to him afterwards, and he can, I'm sure, give you lots of suggestions. So good. This is all wake up. Good. Okay. Look at that. I have no more notes. So this is good. I just wanted to kind of open it up a little bit for more of a conversation, questions, whatever you'd like to talk about would be just fine. So yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, life is filled with big, scary events, you know, even if there are no, you know, terrorist attacks or you know, natural disasters or elections. What I've found, meditation, you know, it's about keeping your seat, right? That you're, you know, you're sitting, and these fears arise, right? Once again, whether it's the big fears or just the small fears, like, you know, I oh my God, I forgot to plug my iPhone in, you know, and I'm not going to have a charged phone, you know. You know, life is scary these days, right? There are many different fears that we can have, you know, or obviously the fear of you know, death and dying, both our, you know, our own ultimate demise, as well as the, you know, the demise of everything that we, you know, everything that we hold dear, right? And so, you know, meditation really helps with that. I find that you know, that just once again, it's this, you know, repeated practice of watching, you know, sitting down and watching your fears arise, right? And feeling them in your body, you know, that flush of panic, right? When you think about the election, you know, and that impatience to know, you know, and that impatience to get this thing resolved and to do something about it, even though you can't, you know. So you notice these feelings arise, right? And then you know, you breathe with them, you feel them in your body, and then you let them go, right? And you return to the breath. And you do that again and again and again. And what happens eventually, I think, at least in my experience, is that a little bit of a gap opens up between, you know, the thought and the response to it, right? So there's this little bit of a gap that starts to open up, and you start to realize that, you know, that these feelings that you're having are workable, that you can work with them, that they don't completely blindside you and knock you off the cushion, right? And so over time, you know, it's that sense of being able to sit with and become intimate with and familiar with your emotions as they arise, or your thoughts as they arise, that gives you a kind of stability, right? And it's not that you don't feel those things, you know. I mean, I don't know how you could watch a debate and not, you know, a presidential debate and not feel things right now, right? And I also confess that I do not watch the debates live. I watch them after the fact, because somehow the idea of watching them live is terrifying to me, and I get too exercised about it. But still, you know, obviously you still feel your feelings, right? You still have your feelings, but there's just that little bit of a sense of, you know, workability there, right? So that's my experience anyway. Yeah. With time, yeah. That's a great. Did everybody hear the question? Let me repeat it. That there are different relationships, you know, that I spoke about different relationships that we have with time. And so the question is, when I unzipped the novel and knew that I was throwing away, a good more than half of it, what did that feel like in terms of time? Did it feel like a failure of time? Did it feel like wasting time? You know, and that was really interesting. This I think I've never done anything quite this drastic in any of the work that I've made. I've never actually thrown away, you know, that many pages of written manuscript before. And it was pretty frightening, you know, at first. What I realized was that it was not wasted at all, because and let me try to explain this, okay? Every single reader who had been in that fictional world contributed something, right? Every single reader who had entered the fictional world, even if that reader was, you know, exiled from the fictional world, still contributed something. And so in a way, it was like, I don't know whether, did you ever play, what is it called, Dungeons and Dragons? Dragons and Dungeons? What was that? Dungeons and Dragons, right? And you know, these games where, you know, you're walking down a path and the path forks and you have to make a decision. I'm either going to go right or left. Okay, so you make a decision and you go left, and you walk down the path and you find things in the path and you pick things up and you put them in your pocket and you continue. So you might pick up a key, you might pick up a branch, a candle, various things, and then you reach a point at an impasse at which you can't go any further, and you realize, oh, should have gone the other way. So you turn around, go back to the fork in the road, and take the right fork again this time. And you're continuing along, right? And suddenly, you find yourself at a door, another impasse. But you have a key. So you take out the key, you put it in the door, you know, the door opens. And then, oh, it's dark inside. Ah, but you have a candle, right? And these are things that you picked up from the wrong, you know, from going down the wrong path, okay? But now you have them. And so suddenly you're opening the doors and you're able to see in places that would have been, you know, impenetrable otherwise, right? And so in that sense, it's not wasted, right? Nothing is wasted. That all of that time, I mean, it's not very efficient. This is not an efficient way of writing a novel, okay? But it wasn't a waste of time either, right? And so this was a huge learning for me, because, you know, I am a fairly impatient person, and so my natural inclination would be to, you know, be sort of cursing myself and my, you know, my slow process and thinking, you know, why can't I write more efficiently? Why can't I, you know? But for a book like this anyway, there was no other way to write it, and I understand that now. And so that's when I say, you know, a book is a time being too, you know, it takes the time it takes. You know, I think that's very true. And I'm hoping that my next book will, you know, be a different kind of time being, one that is a little bit speedier, you know. One can always hope. But then again, I don't know, maybe it'll be even longer, you know. Ah, yes, the time being. Yeah, for the time being. Right.
And I just wondered if you were familiar with it.
Yes. Yeah. She asked about Annie Dillard's book, which is called For the Time Being, and it's a book of essays, or it's linked to essays. It's not even a book of essays. It's a long essay, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. I really recommend it. Annie Dillard is a wonderful, wonderful essayist and writer. And she also wrote another book called The Writing Life, which is one of my favorite books of all time. And I had read For the Time Being when it first came out, and I can't remember when that was. I think it was the early... Oh, 1999? Okay, I thought it was the early 2000s, but... So I read it then, but and I was aware of it, and you know, had read it. But by the time I started writing A Tale for the Time Being, it had kind of receded. And there might be things, you know, there might be things from that book that kind of arose in A Tale for the Time Being, but it wasn't conscious. You know, it's very interesting. You know, recently I reread Harriet the Spy, okay, which is a children's book. And I had read it when I was a little girl. And I hadn't read it in the 50-something years in between. And I was astonished at how closely Now's journey follows Harriet the Spy's journey, right? And I, you know, it was stunning to me how closely those two characters, you know. And I think too, and another book that sort of appeared in A Tale for the Time Being, kind of unconsciously, was Catcher in the Rye. There's a tone that people have commented on. That apparently, you know, and once again, Catcher in the Rye, and you know, the narrator of Catcher in the Rye is a book that I love, and so somehow that tone, I think, infiltrated too. So it's just part of what spins around in the mental gyre and gets sort of spit out in the, you know, in the novel. Yeah. No, actually, that's not. Yeah, it at the very, very beginning, I think when I first heard started hearing the voice, she had a different name, and she had I think three different names at various times, but I kept coming back to Now, you know, and then it became clear to me after a while that was very much her name. But at the beginning, when a character is just starting to form, there's a sense of you know, there's a kind of a nascent period where, you know, they still are just, their limbs and, you know, organs are just, you know, just forming. And so at that point, names are, you know, you're just not quite sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Your book had a lot of ghosts. That surprised me. I imagined that Buddhism didn't believe in ghosts. Mm. Like Catholicism had all kinds of saints and so on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was especially interested. You had one called Iki Sudama.
Yeah.
Segaki,
yeah, the hungry ghosts, yeah,
what
yeah, yeah.
I really thought was Kododama,
oh.
Spirits that live inside a word.
That's right.
Could
that's
you
right.
talk about?
Yeah. Yeah, sure, sure. No, the speaker was just was saying that he was surprised that there were so many ghosts in the book, and that because he hadn't really thought of Buddhism as being a religion that had a lot of ghosts in it, and actually, I mean, I think Buddhism does have a lot of manifestations that can be seen as ghosts. The ghosts that you're talking about here, though, are indigenous Japanese ghosts. So, you know, Buddhism, when it came to Japan, it kind of melded with the indigenous, you know, Japanese lore and spirituality. And so a lot of the ghosts that, that are mentioned in the book are ghosts that have, you know, sort of come into, or I don't even know how directly associated with Zen they are. But the Segaki, the hungry ghost, is a ghost that, you know, a very, very Buddhist ghost that you can trace all the way back to India, you know, to early Buddhism. But the Kotodama, the spirits of the words in particular, that I think is Japanese, but it's possible too that there might be precedents for that in China. I'm not sure about that. Maybe somebody else knows. I'm not really sure about that. But this idea that there are certain words that have enlivening spirits in them, and I don't know a whole lot more about it than that. But you know, there is this kind of sense that, and I think we all kind of have an intuitive understanding of this too. That there are words that inside of a word, there is a kind of, you know, and certain words in particular, there is a kind of enlivening spirit that is, you know, that is there and sort of, you know. Refusing to. I certainly feel this way a lot. That words somehow refuse to behave in the ways that I want them to, and that they have a will of their own. And you know, when you think about it, I guess, you know, I've been writing for a long time, and I think a lot about words, and I think a lot about language, and Really, when I started practicing Zen seriously, and especially when I started practicing Zen as a priest, a lot of the things that I do are ritual based, right? So I practice, you know, I do service and various other kinds of ritual, chanting and prostrations, and you know, so these are rituals that are passed down, you know, through the centuries, right? And After practicing, you know, Zen like that, I've started to think about language too as a kind of ritual act that, you know, it conforms to, you know, to what we think of as ritual. It's a series of acts with, you know, that are rule bound and culture bound that are passed down to us from our ancestors, right, and are passed forward, and they almost travel through us and through our bodies and, you know, through our bodies and our mouths, and are passed down to the next generation. And so but because language is something that, you know, we practice so naturally, right, we don't really see it as being a ritualistic act, but I actually think it is a ritualistic act. And so, especially within that context, there are certain sort of ritual objects, certain words that act like ritual objects. So, for example, if I said fuck, right, suddenly there's an object that is, you know, that disrupts, right? And that, so why is that? Is that Kotodama, or is that some other kind of, you know, is there something else going on in that, you know, sort of ritual act? So anyway, it's hard to know whether it's a real ghost or whether it's something else, but certain words do have this kind of power. And I think that, you know, as a writer, this is fascinating to me. Excuse me for swearing, everybody. I apologize for that. Yeah, you know, anything to make a point, right? Yeah, way in the back. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did everybody hear that question? So she was talking about My Year of Meats and saying that she could see similarities between the two works, but that they're also quite different. And she just was asking me to address, you know, what happened during that, you know, how the two works are related and how they are different. Yeah, you know, in between My Year of Meats and A Tale for the Time Being, I wrote another book called All Over Creation. Okay, and All Over Creation was really a work that was very thematically related to My Year of Meats, in that it's a book about a farming family and in Idaho, and about the problem with genetically modified foods, potatoes in this case, and the cast of characters is bigger in that book, right? And so in this book, in A Tale for the Time Being, I went back to this idea of interleaved or alternating chapters, one of them written in the first person, the other one written in the third person, right? So now sections are all written in the first person, right? And the Ruth sections are written in the third person. So, and that was the same technique that I used for My Year of Meats. You know, My Year of Meats was a very, it was a book that I wrote. Let's see, now I wrote that book in 1997. It was the first novel that I wrote. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was, you know, sort of teaching myself how to write novels, and I had just come out of the film business too. So I was giddily happy to be, you know, to be writing that book, primarily because after making films, I realized that writing a novel is just like really easy, you know. After trying to make films, right? And it's cheap, right? It's incredibly cheap to write a novel, whereas it's really expensive to make a film. So I was kind of a little bit slap happy in that book, and you know, giddy with excitement, and was experimenting with a lot of different kinds of things. And so I think that in A Tale for the Time Being, My Year of Meats kind of set sort of broke ground in a way for me, and it broke ground in a way that allowed me to come back to it in A Tale for the Time Being and incorporate different kinds of texts. So, for example, in My Year of Meats, there were faxes and newspaper articles and scenarios, scripts, you know, documentary scripts, and various other kinds of you know, sort of texts. Interleaved, you know, interspersed within the novel. In this one, there were the letters and the diaries and you know, different kinds of texts like that. So I was coming back to that again. But this book, in many ways, was a more internal book, I think, and it was more deeply personal, right? My Year of Meats was also personal, but this one is, you know, this one was took another step inside, right? So now, you know, now I don't know what to do for the next book. You know, I don't know exactly where to go with it. But I also think that both books, and actually all of my work, I've always been playing with, you know, identity, right? As a, you know, mixed race Japanese American writer, writing in English in America now. When I write a book with a mixed-race female character, right, there is no way that that most of my readers in America, there's no way that they will read that character and they will inevitably think that character is an autobiographical character, right? It's because of the racial and cultural specificity of me, of my identity, right? And this is something that a white male author does not necessarily, you know, does not necessarily share, right? Many white male American authors write about, you know, a white male character, and readers don't automatically assume, oh, that character is an autobiographical character, right? But when you start dealing with specificities, racial and cultural specificities like mine, right, then, you know, that's a natural assumption, right? And so in all of my work, I've been playing with this notion of autobiography. I started doing this in my film work, and I have, you know, was in my films, very often sort of playing a role in my films, kind of playing with this notion of what's real and what's not real, you know, what's truth and what's fiction, right? And this is a kind of an investigation that I've continued throughout all of my work, and I think it's really most evident in A Tale for the Time Being, where I actually sort of step into the book as a character, and sort of, you know, inhabit that role in a more overt way, right? My Year of Meats was Jane Takagi Little was the protagonist, right? She was a mixed race, half Japanese, half Caucasian character who was a filmmaker in New York, okay, very much like myself, right? And I knew that people would think that this was an autobiographical character. And so in that book, I gave her a different name, and I made her 6 feet tall, and I gave her green hair so that people could tell us apart, right? whereas in this book, I just thought, you know, screw it. I'm just gonna be the character and let people make what they want out of it. Yeah, over there. Yeah.
Can you tell us who some of the other readers were?
Mm. Yeah. Boy, there were about four, I think, in total. What's interesting is that some of them were male, some of them were female, some of them were in between. Okay. What I noticed was that. Okay, so I would invite the character in, and the character would start to interact, right? And at the point at which the character started to develop specificity, in other words, the character started acting like a character ought to act, right? And started becoming, you know, having desires and opinions and really starting to come alive on the page, right? That's when I'd realize, oh, wrong character. Okay. And so what happened was that at every iteration, I would make the character less specific. I know this is really stupid. Now when I talk about this, it sounds so dumb. But that was my, you know, since I'd noticed that it was a specificity that was a problem, I just kept making the character less and less specific until in that final draft that I mentioned, right, that was not a very good draft, the character of the reader was a character with no name, no gender, okay, no age, no job, right? It was written in the first person, right? So if you write in the first person, you don't have to specify gender, right? Very few friends and a huge collection of symptoms. Right? Neurotic symptoms, right? And so, of course, I mean, you can see why this was not a very good book, right? This was a kind of a terrible book, because who wants to read a character like that, right? But what I realize now, looking back on it, that's so fascinating to me, is that the character was a placeholder, right? The character was a kind of a cipher, and it was just holding the place, you know, in the novel, and keeping me going, right? Until the answer until the right conditions arose for me to be able to step into the, you know, into the book. The other thing I should mention is that when I started writing it in 2006, I keep a process journal, okay? And my process journal is it's like my friend, and I talk to my process journal, and I tell my process journal all of my writing problems. And my process journal can also be like a teacher and give me homework assignments and give me deadlines and, you know, encouragement. And the good thing about a process journal is that they, you know, your process journal never gets bored with you, you know, and so is endlessly fascinated with all of my, you know, my writing dilemmas. And in my process journal, in 2006, I have an entry that says something like, oh, well, you know, I'm the one who's hearing now's voice. Maybe I'm the reader. And that was one night. And the next morning, the process journal entry was, that idea sucks. You know, it's too metafictional, it's too postmodern, it's too much like what guys do in their books, so I'm not going to do that, right? And I ditched it, right? I ditched it. And then 5 years, and I think I was right at the time. It was not the right thing to do. It was too self-conscious. It felt kind of like, ugh, not right. And it wasn't the right time to do it. Then fast forward, you know, 5 years, everything changed, and suddenly it was now time to do that. It was now time to go back to that idea that I had discarded 5 years earlier, right? So the other thing that was interesting is that I mentioned before that every iteration of the reader, you know, was necessary. I remember there was one iteration where the reader was a 50-something-year-old man who was a little bit prurient. Right, and a little bit, there was a kind of a peeping Tom thing going on, right? And that was the time when Now's story got dark, right? That was the time, and it makes perfect sense because, of course, a reader like that would be, you know, expecting, you know, that kind of sexual, you know, kind of prurient stuff to start to happen, right? That's what he was looking for, and so that's what started to happen, right? So that was an important part of the book, too, and if at that moment, you know, the reader had been, you know, a different character, then probably Now's story wouldn't have gone in that direction, right? So this is what I mean. It's just each reader brought his or her own, you know, interest or whatever to the story. And that's why I don't feel like it could be, you know, I can't really consider this to be a waste of time, even though, as I said, it was not efficient. So anybody who's writing, writers in the audience, this is not a recommendation of how to do things. Good. Yeah, right here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. The question is about the end, and you know, how definitive is the end, and how open-ended is the end, and you know, how does one best interpret it? So my feeling about, you know, the writing and reading process is that there is no one definitive version of the book. You know, that there are as many A Tale for the Time Beings as there are readers who pick it up, right? It's a collaboration. And so I do my part, and then I send it out into the world, and you read it. And so the Tale for the Time Being that you and I create is one thing, right? Very different from the Tale for Time Being that you and I create, or that you and I create, right? It's you know, to get quantum, you know, not to get too quantum on you, but it's not a particle. It's not a singular particle. It's an array, right? It's a huge array, right? And it really is like a multiverse at that point, right? And so as a result, you know, my feeling was very much that I wanted to keep the ending, I wanted to keep it, you know, open to possibilities. I wanted it to feel, you know, to be open to many different possibilities. And, you know, so then, you know, whoever reads it will, you know, have a feeling about how it ends. And your feeling might change over time, too. So that at one reading, you might think it ends this way, but then at another reading, it might end in another way. I was very aware that of wanting to create different levels of the reading experience so that it could be read as a piece of, you know, almost psychological realism. You know, and I think you suggested this. Is this a kind of a description of a slightly mad writer's, you know, process, right? And you know, in other words, is how much of this just exists in Ruth's, you know, demented mind? Well, I mean, a lot of it does, obviously. But you know, so that you could read it almost as psychological realism, you could read it as magical realism, you could read it as, you know, I remember thinking at one point testing it out to see if at every juncture it would work in accordance to, you know, sort of quantum principles. I remember at one point testing it and thinking, you know, does this work as a kind of a performance of, you know, Dogen Zenji's Uji? So is there a Buddhist reading of this, right? And so trying very hard to kind of keep these different readings going throughout the book. And so as a result, at the end, you know, I don't have a definitive ending for it. I have a sense of, you know, of what may or may not have happened. But I certainly don't have any definitive idea. My sense is that, you know, the last thing that happens in the book is that Ruth writes a letter to Nao, right? And we've already seen what happens when a writer writes and sends words out into the world, right? We've seen what happens, what arises in response to that, right? Generally, you know, Nao sent her diary out into the world, and Ruth found it and responded, right? So we've seen that kind of, the whole book is about that, right? And so my feeling is that, you know, when Nao, you know, when Ruth writes that letter to Nao in the end, you know, well, we kind of know what happens, right? What happens when a writer sends a missive out into the world like that? You know, the reader arises to meet it, but you don't know. Yeah. Yes. Well, I was, you know, I was playing around with, with quantum physics metaphors throughout the book, and so there were certain, well, the theories of quantum mechanics, physics, right, and so and I was playing with, the various things, like, for example, Schrodinger's cat, right, which is a very famous physics, quantum physics thought experiment. I was playing with, one of the characters, Haruki number two, is involved in quantum computing. I was playing with different quantum physics, ideas, like, for example, entanglement. Or, you know, and so these are things that, you know, sort of that I was playing with in the book, including this idea that, things appear to be either a singular entity or an array. Okay. So for example, in the example I just gave was that this book, you know, it appears to be a singular entity, right? Fixed in time and space. But in fact, it's not that simple, because when you read the book, you and I create one version of it, whereas other people will create a different version of it. So it's not just one book; it's an array. And this actually dovetails very nicely with Buddhist, you know, certain ideas in Zen Buddhism. There's several. There's a particular. Well, I don't want to get too detailed about this, but this idea of the notion of the many and the one, okay, and so this you know, the overlap there was intriguing to me, and so that's kind of what I was playing with, yeah, over here, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And then the events are unfolding as now, but at the same time, she has disappeared in the end, but also imminent. So I was fascinated about that idea that time is time actually passing, but as we just said, also interlocking. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about the age, race, and the time.
Well, there's many different ways of thinking about that, but yes, I was certainly playing, I was making a pun on the word now, N-O-W, and N-A, the name Naoko, right? So that was very much there. And I was also thinking a lot about the experience of reading itself. You know, that when we read, we are, in a way, reading these words that were written by a mind that no longer exists, right? So to put that slightly differently, you know, I'm sitting up here talking to you about this book that apparently I wrote, okay? But I say apparently because I'm not the same person who wrote this book, right? I'm a different person. The person who wrote this book, you know, this book was, let's see now, written in, the last editing was done in, I think, 2012, and now it's 2016. So, you know, very different person, right? The person who wrote this book was a writer, right? The person who is standing up here talking to you is an author. Very different, right? The author, you know, this is like, I'm like the PR arm, you know? I'm like the PR arm of this entity, right? But the writer writes, you know? The author talks about writing, okay? Very, very different experiences. And so, you know, this gets into sort of notions of self, too, right? You know, and I was really enjoying playing with that, you know? The Ruth in the book is obviously not me, right? But is she? You know, she is and she's not me, right? I didn't find, you know, a diary literally washed up on the shore in British Columbia, right, in Whaletown. But I did hear the voice of this girl sort of washed up on the shores of my imagination, okay? So, you know, different and same, right? So, so these are the kinds of things that I was thinking about. And, you know, the whole notion of written language is fascinating. I mean, it's, you know, it's all about time. Right, it's all about time. You know, the Greeks, ancient Greeks, used to think that, you know, when you recited the poetry of a dead poet, right, and you recited the poetry of a dead poet, it was the poet who was borrowing your tongue, right, borrowing the tongue of the living, the mouth of the living, in order to express himself. Right. And so these are things that, as a writer, I think about a lot, you know, and it's fanciful in some way, but it is all about, you know, it's all about sort of, you know, the ways that we reach forward and backward in time, right, to connect with each other, right? And it also is a very kind of expansive, you know, I mean, it's a very expansive notion of what time is as well, right? So these are the kinds of things I was playing with. Yeah. Yeah, over here. And tell me if people want to, you know, feel free to leave, in other words. But, yeah.
I think this follows from the previous question. Mm-hmm. What seems to me, at least, to be the moment in the novel, mm-hmm. a critical moment, it's somewhat abstract, not just a point.
Yeah.
Buddhism seems to break through what most of us seem to think is a fundamental barrier
mm-hmm.
of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was going on there, indeed. Well, that's a good question. You know, in dreams, we do this all the time, right? And so Ruth was actually dreaming at that time, right? And in dreams, we do break through those barriers, right? Or what we perceive as those barriers. So, you know, one interpretation is that Ruth is dreaming, and in fact she is dreaming. We know that. We see that. And we see her traveling, you know, through space and time in her dreams, right? As we all do. As we all do. We're lying there in bed sleeping, but we are in some other world in some other time, right? So that is a kind of realistic interpretation, right? But I also think that, you know, when I was writing that section, I was thinking very much about the way that we construct these barriers, Right. And in Japan, we talked about ghosts earlier, but in Japan, the barrier between the living and the dead is not as permeable, is not as fixed, is not as rigid as it is in this culture, right? It's a permeable barrier. And so, you know, every year at Obon, for example, the ghosts, you know, the ghosts of your relatives come back, right? They come back to this world and you feed them, right? And you celebrate them and then you send them back. Right. In Japan, for example, I think in the book too, the idea of if you have a broken needle or pins, right, broken needles and pins for sewing, right, and you've used them and they've served you well, you don't just want to throw them away, right, because it's not, you know, respectful to the spirit of the object that's helped you all these years. And so you take it to the temple and you put it in a, you know, you dispose of it by putting it in a nice soft block of tofu, right, that's provided for that purpose so that it can be then ritually disposed of. And you really want to be careful with things like pins and needles and scissors, right, because they're sharp and they can hurt you, okay? So you really want to be careful about how you dispose of these objects, right? So my point is just that, these are kinds of, you know, barriers that we have in our mind, right? And every culture has different ones, and so that might just sound kind of quaint to you as a Westerner. But in Japan, there's just a sense that this is common sense. This is common sense. You don't want to throw out your needles and be disrespectful because, ouch, right? And I was thinking about this a lot when I was writing because I realized that in my creative process, I also have lots of walls and barriers. And when I was when I was a young, very young writer and a young reader, I read Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, my world is so boundaried and so, you know, there's just so many walls and his world is just wide open. You know, there's just magic happening everywhere. And that's the kind of writer I want to be. And at the same time, realizing, you know, how boundaried I am, right? I have a very logical, rational, quotidian, kind of boring mind. And so I remember thinking when I started writing this book, I really want to break through these boundaries, these barriers, and move into a different kind of, you know, more permeable, magical relationship with language and reality, right? And I remember approaching that scene that you're talking about, right? And I'm writing, and it's getting closer and closer, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to write through the wall somehow. I don't know how it's gonna, you know. And so I'm getting closer and closer, and finally I'm sitting there nose to nose with that wall, you know, of realism. And I just remember taking a deep breath and pushing and falling through to the other side, right? And realizing, like, wow, there was no wall there at all. The wall was all in my mind, right? And so this was really fascinating to me. And it made me think, well, gosh, maybe that same wall is what we have constructed between our sense of past and present and our sense of present and future, right? Maybe these are just conceptual walls that you know. And certainly in Buddhism, there's a framework for this, you know, for thinking about these things. And Dogen is constantly walking through walls. Dogen is just like, you know, backwards and forwards, walking through walls right and left, you know. So anyway, yeah. Very much so. Thank you. Boundaries keep breaking down. And And so the, yeah, absolutely. Did you all hear this? That it was an interesting comment that gosh, I'm not going to be able to repeat it as well as you just said it, but that in the book, so many boundaries, you know, there's a boundary and then it falls apart. There's a boundary and it falls apart. So boundaries between old people and young people, boundaries between, rap lyrics and, Dogen texts, rap, boundaries between, the U.S. and, or in this case, Canada, the West, and the East, that the book is really filled with different types of boundary breaking. And, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Was there anything else?
Well, even in nature, with the thoughts of...
Oh, yes, right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Japanese crows showing up, the quote, debris field, which I hate that word because these are people's bodies and beloved things, belongings, right, that are form this debris field. But anyway, the things, the people and things that are kind of moving, from Japan to the West Coast, that this is another kind of boundary, boundary breaking or crossing. And, and I think that, I think that's very true. It old Jiko is constantly saying this thing, up, down, no difference, or what does she say? Something like that? Up, down, same thing, right? Up, down, same thing, right? And so she's constantly kind of pointing to this, to the breaking down of boundaries, right? Which is exactly what sort of non-dualistic thinking does, right? It breaks the boundaries between, up, down, right? There's always a way to go up and, look down, and then, but when you come down here and, it's you're constantly flipping positions. It's a relative phenomenon, right? And so this is, the book really, I think, very much takes on that kind of boundary crossing. And I have to say, too, that, for somebody who grew up looking like this, and grew up, mixed blood, that it's all about boundary crossing, right? I mean, this is the metaphor of my life, right? I am that metaphor. And, it's certainly, I've been aware of it ever since I was a very little kid and never quite understood where the boundary should go. I knew that I was half Japanese, right? That's what I used to be referred to, half Japanese. So then, is the boundary here? Or is it here? Top half, bottom half? Where is the line that divides me, right? And so this is a metaphor that I've been, or a koan that I've been pondering throughout all of my life, and certainly all of my, my writing life. Yeah. Yes, Tegan.
You said something about Jiko's wonderful 94-year-old Japanese
dance track,
like this Yoda figure. She's very down to earth.
Yeah.
She's this wonderful character.
Yeah. Sure. Taigen's asking me to speak a little bit about old Jiko, who he very wonderfully calls a kind of a Yoda-like figure, and I completely agree with that. So old Jiko is a funny character because, I'm not sure exactly where she came from. I know certain elements of her. I know that she certainly shares my mom's sense of humor. My mom had a wonderful sense of humor, even when she was, deeply into her, demented Alzheimer's phase. She still was always very funny. And so there's a little bit of mom in old Jiko. There's also, I think that old Jiko is funny because I think that she's a kind of an archetype. And I think people respond to old Jiko because, even if, you don't have a 104-year-old anarchist feminist, great-grandmother, Japanese Buddhist nun grandmother yourself, you still know. You still do, right? We all have our inner old Jiko, I think. We all have that internalized. And so I think that's what makes her, kind of a recognizable and successful character. Fighting that fight there. And so, but the other thing too is that the other inspiration for old Jiko is a real life nun, which I told you a little bit about her, but there was this wonderful Japanese novelist named Setouchi Harumi was her name. And she's she was a novelist, But now she is a Tendai Buddhist nun in Japan. Okay, she's not old, you know, like old Jiko. She's relatively young. I think she is 90 something now. She was very popular in the early part of the 20th century in Japan. She wrote very racy novels. Very, very, very racy novels. And she was famous for writing about sex from a woman's point of view. So she was labeled a pornographer by her mainly male, the literati of the time. And she suffered tremendously. Okay. And when she was 50-something, oh, that's right, she had affairs and she wrote about them. She eventually she was married to an older man. She had an affair with his student. She had to leave the marriage. She was forced to abandon her child. The husband's family wouldn't give her the child. It series of really rough things. So when she was in her 50s, she had a bit of a nervous breakdown. And that's when she decided that she wanted to give it up. She wanted to shave her head and become a nun. Okay. And so she had a friend who was a Tendai monk and a writer friend who was a Tendai monk. And he took her kind of under his wing and agreed to ordain, to give her ordination, and so she went ahead with it, and it was interesting because I've read some of the correspondence between them, and he was like, Harumi, traditionally women we shave the head, but she was a sex object, right? She was kind of like the sexy woman, and he was like, well, maybe you don't want to shave your hair right away, it's okay if you take your time, and she's like, no. Hair's going, right? And then at some point he said, well, there's also this issue of celibacy in the Tendai, most Tendai, in fact, all Tendai nuns, they are celibate, so there is this issue of celibacy, and are you going to be able to give it up, And she was like, absolutely, just watch me, right? And she did. She did. She gave it all up. Shaved her head, became celibate, moved into a nunnery, worked within the church for many years. And then at the time, I remember there was this interview that I read where she said she was perfectly willing to give up writing if that's what it took, right? She felt that she couldn't continue writing the way it was going up until then. She needed a backbone. That was her way of describing it. She needed a backbone in order to continue writing. And so she was willing to give it up if that's what happened, right? And luckily it she was able to continue. And so she did a very, very important, big important work, which was to translate the Tale of Genji, which is written in classical Japanese. She translated the Tale of Genji into modern Japanese, and it was the first modern translation that had been done for quite a while, and it really was her translation in the sense that she, Tale of Genji was written originally by a woman and subsequently had been translated by men. So this was a woman's novel that was now being translated by a woman, and it had a certain kind of sexiness to it in her translation, apparently. I haven't read it, but that was, that made it suddenly a bestseller. This was a huge breakthrough, and she also she was given so many honors in Japan, and she's a national living treasure, and various things. But when cell phones started to be used, right, the old flip phones, there was this trend in Japan where young women, in particular, would sit and on the train, because they would have these long commutes into the city, and they would sit and write novels on their cell phones, right. And then they would upload the novels to, the installments to a server. And then other women, usually young women, could download the novels and read these little bits of novels every day, right? So this was very, very popular. And Jakucho, her Dharma name is Jakucho. Jakucho decided, well, if this is the genre that young people are using today, then I must learn to do this too. And so she taught herself how to text. Actually, apparently she cheated. She used a computer and then somebody put it in for her. But in any case, she started writing cell phone novels. And so this is what gave me the idea of old Jiko, this really old nun texting in order to talk to her granddaughter and make communication with their granddaughter. And the other thing that's interesting about Jacucho is that she's a very, very powerful political activist. And so she, after 3/11, when, temporarily anyway, the Japanese government shut down the nuclear plants and then proceeded to try to open them again, Jacucho was out there in her wheelchair on the picket lines, blocking the reopening of the nuclear plants. And so she's done this several times. She has gone on hunger strikes. She's, she's a real strong activist, and she's somebody who I admire tremendously. And the last funny story I'll tell about her is that I read this interview with her, and the interviewer asked this question, is there anything you regret about your decision to ordain? Right, and to become a Buddhist nun. And she thought about it for a moment, and she said, if I'd known that I was going to live this long, I might have waited. And she was talking about the celibacy clause. So she's really quite a character. So, okay, well, I don't see any more. Oh, we got one more. Should we do one more question? And I'm completely, yeah. Yeah. Oh, it was Jacucho. Jacucho. Seto Uchi. Her last name is Seto Uchi. So it's Setouchi. Seto Uchi Jacucho. You can find various, things about her on the internet. It's really lovely. What do you think? Good? Okay. Well, thank you all very much. You've been a wonderful... Thank you for your great questions. Thanks.